I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether that's a hike up the mountains, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Sally Hansen. Sally Hansen herself was more than a beauty innovator and businesswoman. She believed in the importance of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Sally Hansen believes that beauty is better when you do it yourself. So this summer, why not get a salon finish on your nails with Miracle Gel and a perfect flawless tan with the iconic Airbrush Lex Tan. And just like Sally herself, enjoy every self-caring moment of it. Welcome to a very special episode of the Good Glow podcast with my gorgeous husband, Jamie, who was here last year to talk a lot about my story. But today he has his own story to tell. And I'm so proud of him for being here today, for opening up and for speaking his truth. So I'll hand it over to Jamie now. He's going to just fill us in a little bit about what happened to us in 2012.
Well, so this is a story I've never really told anybody. Only a few close friends and obviously my family know about this. But in 2012, in March 2012, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So I have MS.
It's weird to hear you say it because we don't. Obviously, the world fell apart for us in 2012, and we'll go into all the details about what happened and where we are now. But I just wanted to say before, you know, we go any further, I'm really proud of you for coming to this decision to talk about it. You're definitely, we've been talking about this for about 6 months, and you feel like the time is right now.
Yeah. Well, it's not one particular thing that's got me to this point. It's, I guess, a collective of things. One, I'm nearly 40. I'm 40 next week. Two, it's World MS Day on Saturday just gone, May 30th. And I thought it was important to raise awareness for that, having, you know, got the disease. But also, I'm a lot more comfortable with having it than I have ever been. I'm a lot fitter. I'm a lot healthier. I feel mentally much stronger than I have since the day of diagnosis about it. So that's kind of a number of reasons why I've decided to talk about it.
I definitely think, especially in the last few years, that we have been on such a journey, and I have seen such a change in you. Like, obviously, you're out running so much these days, the trail running. You're very at peace with yourself. You go sea swimming. We look at to Jerry Hussey a lot for inspiration on being our true selves and acceptance and non-attachment. We went to Jerry's seminar earlier this year, and I think we both got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
First of all, maybe just tell us a little bit about what MS is.
So MS is a disease of the central nervous system. It's an autoimmune disease. And what happens when you have MS, and they don't know why this happens or what the trigger is to start it, but your immune system basically attacks yourself. It attacks your central nervous system. So all the nerves in your body and in your brain are basically wrapped in a fatty protein or a fatty sheath called myelin. And the myelin is attacked. Your immune system sees it as a foreign invader and attacks it and creates kind of plaques on it. So the best way of describing it is the wire on this microphone. If you pared back the protective cover on the wire, and as you were doing that, you sort of damaged the inside cable in there. That's basically what happens when you have an attack of MS.
Mm-hmm.
So it can affect people in number of different ways, and it's a really hard disease to diagnose because it can look like so many other things. So you know, it can cause numbness, it can cause imbalance, it can cause incontinence, it can cause you know, a host of things that you don't know. It can cause blindness, it can cause deafness, it can cause anything that your nerves are involved with. It just depends on where the MS attacks, either your brain or your spinal cord. So, you know, that is my amateur summary of what mm-hmm. MS is.
And so let's just talk a little bit about what life was like for you before MS. So
yeah.
we were dating about 6 months when you were diagnosed. We were in the very early stages of our relationship. And like, I had felt that our honeymoon period was almost robbed from us because things got serious so quickly for us. But I really felt like we were meant to be together in March 2012. To support each other and get each other through it. But just tell us a little bit about what your life was like in before your diagnosis.
Yeah, it was. So I was always exceptionally kind of career focused. So I was working in Spin at the time. I had started in Spin at the age of 23, and I was handing out flyers as a spinny. And best job of my life, worked really hard. I could see a growth pathway and I wanted to become the marketing manager there. That was my degree. I was really into marketing. So I just worked my ass off for 2-3 years and I got that position after 2 or 3 years of working there. You know, some days we were working 14 days in a row. Like, it was, and that was by choice. That was not, we weren't made to do that. It was, I just wanted to do it because I loved it and I wanted to prove a point to management that I was, you know, committed to this. So yeah, I became the marketing manager there, and at the age of 28 I got brought into a meeting and asked, did I want to be the CEO? So obviously I said yes, and that's, I suppose, when I went, oh shit, how do I do this? Like, I'm only 28 years of age and I've grown up with all these people that I work with, and then now I have to be their boss and all
and
that
kind of
stuff.
And what was that? What did you feel like when they said to you, will you be the CEO? Like, did you expect that?
Well,
did you feel
I,
like that was coming?
I could see a path for me to that. Like, I could see the path for me to the marketing position. Once I got to the marketing position, I was like, right, what's next? Where can I grow to now? So I just, you know, did what I needed to do, like work really hard and, you know, dedicate every single ounce of energy to getting to that space. And it happened sooner than I thought it did, but it was too good of an opportunity to turn down. And the faith that senior management within Communicore and all had in me was, you know, I was so blown away by that. So I just was like, I have to take this. And I was delighted and I took it, and it was a game changer, really, in terms of, at the time, it was a game changer in terms of, it was like, well, now the hard work actually begins.
Mm-hmm. And what was your lifestyle like in those days? Were you exercising? Like, you've always played hockey your whole life. Were you keeping that up?
Yeah, I played hockey, but no, I probably made a conscious decision to be, you know, I've got to learn here. I'm only 28 and I'm chief executive of a company with 80 people in it at that stage. So I decided to, yeah, just sort of maybe just take a step back from the hockey and all that sort of stuff and work really, really hard. So, you know, 7 a.m., 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. almost every night. And that went on for years. And I just got into that habit and that just became normal to me.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really consciously think about that wasn't normal, and it wasn't due to any other reason bar my own drive to be the best that sort of made me work like that.
I think after you were diagnosed, I really started thinking about our lives, and it dawned on me that you would drive to work in the dark and drive home in the dark and eat your lunch at your desk.
Yeah.
That was just normal life for you.
It was, and that was, you know, part of having MS. It's kind of a northern hemisphere disease. So where there's little sun or sunlight, there's a lack of vitamin D in people's bodies. And certainly with me, I was deficient in vitamin D when I went to hospital and got tested for that. So I was very, very low in vitamin D. And that was because I was going into work, staying in there and working hard and you know. I loved it though. Like, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's important to say that I absolutely loved it. I loved what I did, but I loved it so much I kind of forgot about everything else.
Yeah,
and
because
my own health, like.
And I worked in Spin at the time too, and I started as a spinny, and I remember you gave us all so much hope because we were like, oh my God, the CEO was a spinny. Mm. And, you know, that we could be like that too. And he believes in us. And I remember you always took such an interest in the street team because you had walked that path. Mm. So the thing about Spin is as well is we had so much fun in there. It wasn't like you went in and it was head down for 12 hours.
No, not
like
at all.
We had the crack together. We were like family. We all believed in the same thing, getting this cool radio station to number one. And we were all doing the best we could to achieve that.
Yeah. That was the goal. And I think everyone in there believed we were the best. The ratings just didn't tell us that. So there was this weird internal drive for everyone in there who just loved it. And it was an amazing place to work and literally the best time of my life working there with amazing people. But we all had this drive to do it. We were all pulling in the same direction. And the energy, I always said, the energy behind the speakers comes out through the speakers and people should feel that when they're listening to the radio. And I think you did it in Spin. We had so much fun. Like Spin was a party, but a real hard working party all mm-hmm. day, every day. Great crack.
I remember Lauren Kelly stood up one day and said, each one of us is the loudest and most annoying person in each of our friends group. And now we all work together. Yeah. I was like, that is such a good way of putting
it. That sums it up exactly what it was, yeah.
So tell us then a little bit about the start of 2012. And
yeah, 2012 was, it was tough. It was so like, obviously I got that position in 2008 at the age of 28. And what happened in 2009 was the global recession. And so everything was, it was really tough from the get-go. And then probably coming out of 2011 into 2012 was, you know, there was some green shoots, but radio wasn't feeling the green shoots within the economy. So it was still really, really hard. So it was, you know, working those same hours, trying to keep the place going and keep people in jobs and, you know, I took it so personally because I loved it so much. I took everything I did in there so personally. And I took it on myself to make sure that, you know, I felt like I was making sure that everyone had a job and was enjoying their job and we were all in it together, you know. So it was hard work, yeah. And then I suppose on the 2nd of February, it was early February, I remember the day to this day, I woke up in the morning and it was Jane Lore Day. And for anyone listening, Jane Lore is like your radio listenership day. You get it once a quarter, so four times a year, you get your results of how you're performing. So it was that day and I remember, you know, coming into that, we'd had a bad Jane Lore the previous one and I was kind of stressed about it and again, taking it all on my own shoulders. Kind of, you know, taking it on me, that's a personal thing that, you know, I'm not getting this place to work properly. I woke up that morning and I remember reading my phone in the bed and sort of leaning on my elbow while I was doing it. And as I was doing that, I was like, oh, I'm leaning on a nerve here, like my hand is all numb. And then I went into work and it just didn't go away. It was like 3 hours later, I was like, why is my hand numb? And then I put my hand up, my hand up to my elbow and my whole arm was numb and I was like, that's weird. And then by that evening my face was numb, like the right side of my face was all numb, like I couldn't really feel my lips and like my face wasn't sagging or anything, it was just kind of numb. And then I noticed that like my foot was a bit numb. I was like, that's weird. Anyway, it was Jane Lore Day, so we were really busy and I just kind of parked that and, you know, I was like, that strange. And then the next day was our friend Dave and Linda's wedding, so I wasn't in work. So we got up that morning, I remember getting up late and the thing hadn't gone, it was all still there, and I was going, that's so weird, I must get this checked out or whatever. I mean, we went to the wedding and we had a great time, and I just remember feeling at the wedding not being 100%. I was very tired, even though I'd had a big lie-in that morning. Mm-hmm. I was really tired, and like, I don't know, you remember back in those days, I would have always been the one at any sort of party like that to be almost the last man standing or trying to be the last man standing. But I remember saying to you at once the kind of main bit of the wedding was over, let's go to bed, I'm tired. And we went to bed and Then the next day, a couple of days later, I remember saying it to my dad, and my dad was like, you should just go to the doctor and get it checked out. Like, it's probably nothing, but, you know, you're stressed or a migraine or something like that. You should go and get it looked at. So I did that. I went to my GP, who was brilliant, actually. Like, he was a bit mad, but he was completely brilliant. He basically said, yeah, it could be MS or it could be nothing, but you should probably, I'm going to refer you to a neurologist. And I went, wait, what? Hang on a second. It could be MS. And he goes, yeah, but look, I have patients with MS and they're fine. Like, it's not the disease it used to be. And, you know, everyone's journey with MS is different. But I had a woman in here the other day. I've been treating her for 30 years and she's fine. And I was like, all right. And that to this day has stuck with me, that he said that. Because that's given me kind of hope with my journey and what, you know, what the next 20, 30 years lies for me. But he kind of just was very nonchalant about it. And he was just like, oh, okay, here you go. Here's your appointment. See you later. So yeah, that was that initial period. And then about a week later, everything had gone. Like, I felt, apart from feeling really tired, oh, and weird stuff started to happen to me. I started walking into door frames, which might sound really stupid, but you know, if you're walking through a door, like, my shoulder would brush off the door. That is the thing that stuck around for ages. So my hand was fine, my face was fine, my foot was fine. My balance was a bit off. So I would think, or my spatial relations were a bit off. So I would go to walk through a door and I'd clip it with my shoulder, just very lightly. I'd be like, why am I doing that? That's so weird. And that stuck around for a couple of weeks. But then everything went back to normal. And that was, the next stage was my neurology appointment.
So I remember one day, because the days are a bit of a blur for me, but I remember you called me down to your office one day and you were like, they want me to go to hospital for a week to try get to the bottom of what's going on here.
Yeah. So I went to see a neurologist and then he did an assessment on me. And then he called me and he said, yeah, we want you to come into the Hermitage for a week and do a number of tests. And at that stage, they didn't know whether it could have been that I had a tiny stroke or MS or ALS, or which is motor neuron disease, or
migraine,
or yeah, because you can get migraines that don't actually hurt. They just knock your balance off and they make your vision blurred and stuff like that. But they don't, there's no pain. So I had no pain at all. So I was like, okay, grand. So I had this myriad of tests that I had to go to hospital for. So yeah, I remember telling you about that, and that's when it kind of started getting a bit real and going, oh shit.
I think that was the time that I started to get freaked out, because I think you kept saying, oh, you know, when we were going to Dave Davin's wedding, you were like, this is wrong and this is weird. And I was just like, you're just stressed, you're just tired, you're pushing yourself too far, you need a break, you know, we need to go on holidays, we need to get away. But then when you said to me, they're sending me to hospital for a week, I was like, oh God. And we had a staff meeting shortly after you told me that. And you had told Brenda Lawler, who worked in, what was her job?
Yeah, sponsorship and promotions.
So she came up, you worked quite closely with her, and she just looked at me across the room and I just burst out crying and went into a studio, and she came in and I was like, this is so weird. Why are they sending him to hospital? And she was like, Jamie works too hard. Jamie's too stressed. You know, this is all, this is just stress, and this is the wake-up call he needs. But little did we know what was waiting for us.
So yeah, I went, I think on the, it was week of St. Patrick's week, wasn't it? In March of that year. So this happened start of February. So 6 weeks later, I went into the Hermitage. And at that stage, I started to get really worried. I remember my mum brought me in, like, 32-year-old man going to hospital. His mum was bringing him in. But, like, my mum and me are, like, really close. And she wanted to be with me while I went in. So I remember sitting down on the bed with my mum and just bursting out crying and going, I know there's something wrong with me. I know this is not just nothing. And she kept saying, it's nothing. You'll be fine. You're fine now. You feel fine now and all that. And I was just like, I just know this is not nothing. And all my life, I had this weird fear of something happening in my brain. I don't know why. My whole life, I've always had some weird fear about that. Growing up, you know, I always had this mad fear about having a brain tumor. I'm really scared of that. And now I had this thing that probably was going to be something like that. My gut was telling me it was, yeah, it was something serious. So yeah, so then that was the Sunday night, and the tests started on Monday, and they were all sorts of tests. There were tests on my heart, running tests, all sorts of, I had to wear trackers, blood test.
But the mood was quite light around that time. Like, I remember I was going in, Julie and Jason, your brother and sister, yeah, your mum and dad, like, we were all really trying our best to keep, yeah, your spirits up. And you were also in the lap of luxury out there in the Hermitage. I was jealous. Yeah. You were resting and watching TV, and we were all bringing in DVDs and, yeah, magazines. Yeah, and
the mood was pretty light. I remember going for scans and stuff. I'm really claustrophobic, so I was being sent for an MRI, and they were like, here's a Valium. And I was like, I'm quite a big guy, so I was like, I need two of them. So he was like, don't give me one, I need two, and like joking with the nurse. And then I remember you and me going down to the ward there, and like, I was pissing myself laughing going in there. It was all, mm-hmm, kind of funny. Like, I kind of had forgotten the whole thing. And obviously that was the Valium kicking in and stuff like that. But like, my general mood was pretty good. But as we went on, one particular test stood out to me on the list. And they started knocking off a lot of tests about heart and blood related problems. So that meant the stroke was probably being ruled out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this eye test that they only do it if they're looking for MS. And I was sent into the eye and ear, and you brought me in to the eye and ear to do that. And that was when I was like, oh, I feel like I have MS. And that was the Wednesday,
mm-hmm,
of that week. And I remember going in and doing it, and you put your face in this thing and all these flashing lights come on, and you press a button when you see a red dot or something like that. I can't really remember the exact ins and outs of it, but I did it, and I left just thinking, oh, that, I found that a little bit weird or hard, but my eyes were fine. I knew they were fine. Yeah, that's when I started to really panic.
So the next morning was the morning.
So then the next morning was the Thursday the 15th of March, and my neurologist came up, and
this is Dr. Ronan Walsh.
Yeah, Dr. Ronan Walsh, my neurologist, came up, and he said, okay, well, we're down to like a couple of tests still to do, and the next one is a lumbar puncture. And I kind of said, wait, can I just stop you there? Because, you know, me being me, I was like probing stuff and trying to find out what was actually going on. And I said, I've gone through all these tests. You've taken all these heart tests off the list. I haven't even done any of them. You're all I can see from what I'm reading about online, because, you know, I do this stuff. I try and find out, mm-hmm, what everything is and why it would be done. So I said, you're just, all you're testing me for now is MS. I can tell. Do I have MS? And he was like, yeah, yes. But I can't 100% confirm it until I do a lumbar puncture. And then he was like, okay, so are you ready for this? And I was like, wait, I have MS. And then he was like, I can't 100% confirm, but it is looking highly likely that you have MS. It's probably nothing else this could be. But the lumbar puncture will confirm that. So can we do that now? And I just went, no.
Because you'd have to lie there for hours.
Yeah, so anyone that's had a lumbar puncture will know about it. Like, if you have a lumbar puncture, they basically put a needle that has a hole in the middle of it, it's like a knitting needle, very thick needle, through your vertebrae in your spine, into your spinal cord, and drain out your spinal fluid, like, into a cup. And that then goes off and gets tested for whatever. So they tested my spinal fluid for an inflammation and a certain protein.
Mm-hmm.
And that protein shows that you have MS. So he said, do you want to do this now? And I said, no, can you just come back? I need to just like call my mom and dad, and like, I'm freaking out here. So I remember just putting on my hoodie, my Patriots grey hoodie, which I was living in that day, and going out to the hospital, into the car park, and ringing my mom, bursting out crying, and just saying, he told me I have MS. And then I rang my dad. And then I rang my sister and you. Obviously, I rang you. I think I rang you first. And then
You definitely rang your mum first. It's okay.
And I rang my sister. And I remember saying to my sister just had a baby then. She just had her first son, Joshua. And I don't know, I kept saying, I'm never going to have a child now. And I loved Joshua so much. And I was his godfather. And he was like, made me want to have us to have a child. And I just kept saying, I'm never going to have a kid now. And like all these illogical, stupid things just started coming out of my mouth. I didn't want to be alone for the lumbar puncture. So because you have to lie there for 3 hours flat on your back and just think about, okay, great, I have MS. I can't bloody move. And by the way, is this what my, because again, another irrational thought, will that be what my life will be like? Will I be paralyzed? Because paralysis is a huge part of MS or you know, could be. Yeah. So I remember being in the car park and you guys and my mum and my dad were there and then you came.
Yeah. So when we went to the Eye and Ear Hospital, I was completely freaked out after that. Like, I think we had all just been trying to tell you that you didn't have MS, but you know, you had me convinced then that you did. So I went home that night. I got up. I used to work in the breakfast show on the radio station. So I used to go in at 6 and I'd always like put on my makeup at around 8:30 in the morning after one of my bulletins. And I remember it was, I don't know where everyone was, but I just remember it was only me and Michael Brett, who was my program director at the time. And so my direct boss. And Michael obviously knew that you were in hospital because he worked so closely with you. And his office, the door was open and it overlooks my desk. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror as I was doing my makeup and saying, my life will never be the same again, because I knew that there was something different about that day. And I think you had said you were going to see Ronan Walsh and you were going to ask him. So I remember just feeling really on edge and really nervous. And you started ringing me, but you rang me every morning to kind of fill me in on how you were feeling and how the night was. And I answered the phone and you screamed down the phone, I have MS, I have MS. And I remember just thinking, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I just picked up my bag. I shoveled everything from my desk into my bag and I ran out the door. And I remember Michael was like, Georgie, I was gone. I went outside of the Malt House, where it's a busy street, and I lay down on the ground on my hands and knees. And I remember this lady came over and was trying to pick me up. And she was like, oh my God, what's wrong? Are you okay? Are you okay? And I was like, I just got some really bad news. I said, I have to go. And I ran down the road to my car. And I got into my car, rang my mum, and I was just screaming at the top. I think I was about 28. You were 32. There's about 4 or 5 years in between us. So I was about 27, 28. And I remember just being like, oh my God, like, how is this happening to us? My mum was on the M50, had to like pull off the M50. She's, I don't know if you know this, but she sat in her car for 3 hours. Joe had to come down and get her. Like, it was chaos. But I remember I drove to Lucan and I'll never forget that moment with your dad more than I remember it with you. But I remember how your dad hugged me.
He snapped you in half nearly.
Yeah, it was like he was like clinging on to me for dear life, you know, just to be like, you know, your dad loved you guys so much. And it was like he was just heartbroken. And your mum is always the really strong one and she's amazing. And I remember it was just the four of us then, and we just, you just have to keep, you just walk back inside. And
we went to that cafe, I remember, first. Yeah. So there's a cafe upstairs in the Hermitage and we went there. And I remember at that time, one thing that stood out for me was we were sitting there at that cafe and my mum, just the look on her face, I could just see she was purely devastated. She was like staring kind of blankly. My dad at that stage had kind of perked up a bit and he was like, you're going to be fine. I just remember him going, you're going to be fine. you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. And my dad's like was a big dude, and he was really strong, and he just kept grabbing me and squeezing my arm. And like, I was like, you're going to break my arm. Stop doing that. But he was like, you're going to be fine. You're tough. You're tough. And I was just looking at my mum, and my mum was just literally staring blankly, just straight through my face. Like, she wasn't looking at me, but her face was in my direction, you know?
Because you're her baby.
Yeah. And I remember going, right, I need to be strong here for this bit. And just kind of perking up a bit and going, okay, let's go get this lumbar puncture done. And then we got that done. And
I remember you, during the lumbar puncture, you were just lying there and you couldn't move. And it was so weird to have just gotten a diagnosis, like you said a few minutes ago, of MS, and then you're lying and you can't move in a bed. It was horrible.
Well, that's what I didn't want when he was going to do it, and I'd be there on my own. Like, you guys had to leave the room, didn't you?
Yeah.
You guys all left, and then he couldn't get it in. Like, he couldn't get the needle to get into my spinal cord, and eventually he did it. And I'd never faint for anything like that, but I started to just feel really nauseous. So I'm kind of like bent over the table, leaning on the food table that comes in hospital. So my hands are on that. I'm bent over and it goes in. Eventually he goes, okay, I've got it now. So he'd been poking at my back for a while. And eventually I could feel the fluid draining from my spinal cord. And that started to make me just feel really sick and nauseous. And I was like, don't faint, don't faint, don't faint, don't faint. So then he did it, he drained it. I actually turned around and I could see the fluid myself. It was horrible. That's something that'll never leave me. Then he helped me just get onto the bed and lie there. And it was like 3 hours of just, I couldn't move. I had to lie still. But weirdly, right, and I've never said this to you, in that time, it was a really shit time. It was really hard, but I will never forget kind of also this weird happy feeling, because I was saying to my parents, just, you guys just talk. And so, you know, my parents broke up when I was young, but they were really close and they were good friends. And I was like, tell me things about what we did when I was a kid. And yeah, it was tough, but like being there, it was so tough. And then had this other side of things where they were talking about, like, my dad used to race motorbikes. I was like, tell me about the motorbikes. Tell me about, like, when we used to go sailing. Tell me about these things. And they're having, the two of them were having this mad conversation. I was just listening, but I loved it because I never really, you know, got to have those conversations with the two of them.
Yeah. It's very special.
So it was weird. It was like, great, I've MS, but I'm kind of really enjoying this chat, this conversation here. That always stuck in me, that chat that they had that day. And it was like a kind of a happy moment, despite being really sad as well.
Yeah, I remember that night very clearly, that, you know, it's so hard because when you're not educated in something, it's very, very scary. So like when you're told, yes, you have MS, I mean, that's absolutely terrifying when you know, not when you don't know that much about the disease, the same as a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
So it was a very scary time for all of us. And I remember when you came home from hospital then, how devastated we all were, and we all gathered in your mum's house. Like, it was during the day. I remember Jean, my sister-in-law, Jason's wife, came and gave me like this bag of like Rescue Remedy, and we were really, really upset and devastated. But I remember your family, and the Crawfords are so strong and such beautiful people. I remember your whole family just being like, he's gonna be fine. It was nothing but positivity and support. And I think my family rode in behind that, because only a very small amount of people knew. But you were surrounded by such support, and I think the word is support. It was everyone just building you up and building me up too.
Yeah, like, I won't forget that either. Like, you know, friends flew home from my best mate growing up, Mark, flew home from Barcelona, like within 2 days of hearing, like all my really close friends just kind of gathered around me and stuff.
Jonathan Goody was there on the day.
Yeah, and Janine came over, and they were just, I remember actually saying it to them, sitting them down. I remember Janine's face, she just looked so confused. Like, why are we here kind of thing? And I went, but I then said, look, I've been diagnosed with MS, and she burst out crying. And like, because it's a scary thing, like, you know, my biggest concern, and most people have this vision of someone with MS, what they're like. So they're, you know, generally, and people have this vision that they're, you know, a bit debilitated and potentially in a wheelchair, or, you know, because it does have massive physical effects on you as the disease progresses. Mm-hmm. And that's the picture of that people have of MS patients, and that's what they know about. And most kids would have been educated on MS growing up in school. There's a thing called the MS readathon, which still goes on. And I remember doing it in Rathmichael and being told about MS was, and seeing pictures of people with MS, and they were all, you know, either, you know, in wheelchairs or whatever. So like, that's what I thought was my future. Yeah. That's what I was so scared of. But in fairness, I asked the doctor, like, what's the thing? And he said, well, you're fit and healthy now, you just need to go live your life. You don't know. Nobody knows their course with MS. Nobody knows what's going to happen to them.
Tell us a little bit about what Ronan Walsh was saying to you around this time, and, you know, the medication, and what was the plan?
Yeah, so the plan was to put me... he just said, look, you know, you're symptom-free. So what had actually happened in the meantime was that I'd had more attacks, but I didn't know I'd had them. So you can have an attack and not get the numbness or not get the imbalance or any of that stuff. Where you can have it, and you can have quite a lot of pain, or you can have whatever. It's so wide and varied. He had told me, look, your symptoms have been mild so far. They've just been numbness and a little bit of imbalance, but, you know, it's relatively mild, and we hope that will be your course. But we need to put you on medication to basically slow the progression of this disease down. There is no cure for MS. There is no cure. And 10 years ago, there was no drugs for MS. Now there's there's a lot of drugs for MS now. And it's one of the most quickest progressing sort of areas for research, and for they're making massive progress, mm-hmm, with MS, and they hope to eradicate it eventually, or at least create something that can just manage it on a day to day basis. So he told me I'd have to talk to me down the line about my drugs, but just, you know, go home and you'll, like, live your life as best you can. So a couple of weeks later, I went to see him again, and he said, yeah, here's the results of the lumbar puncture. 100% you have MS. This is what we have to do. You have to first round of drugs is a thing called Copaxone, which is an injectable. So I had to be taught how to inject myself. And you put it, so nurse came to the house after that doctor's appointment and basically did my first injection with me, and you pop the top off the needle, and they're in the fridge, they're freezing cold, they have to be kept cold all the time. Put it into the kind of gun thing, grab the fat on your six pack. I had no fat on my six pack, so I had to go somewhere else. Yeah, right. So I grabbed the belly, and yeah, you press the button, and this thing goes boom into your, so, and it stings, it's sore, like it's real sting, and it's because it's cold, the liquid going in is really cold, so you get this kind of lump there you have to kind of massage out. And you use different injection sites every day, so I was on that for a while, but that failed with me, so I had a relapse with that. So the type of MS I have is called relapse remitting MS. So it's the most common, and it's the start of the disease. So I have a relapse, and then I go into remission, and then I have a relapse and I go into remission. And the key is the drugs are supposed to basically stop or slow down the relapses and give your body time to recover from when the next one will appear. And if they can push out the relapses for months, years, decades, then you've a better chance of, you know, being symptom free. So yeah, so that kind of failed quite quickly with me. Well, it was in a year, I think it failed, and, you know, it was fine. I was injecting myself for a year, but I was then moved on to an oral drug. I hated the needles. I absolutely hated them.
They were so annoying because, first of all, we didn't tell many people that you had MS. Mm. Your best mates knew, our families and a couple of work colleagues.
Yeah.
So everywhere we went, we had to bring these injections with us and keep them cold.
Yeah.
But like hide it from people.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like if we were going, I remember we were going away with people once and we were like trying to hide it in the security of the airport. And it was just a lot for us to kind of have these injections everywhere we went and make sure there's a fridge and all that sort of stuff. But so it was in the very early stages of us getting used to this new medication, getting used to our new life, which was, you know, pure healthy food, exercising loads, not going out anymore, to thinking about, you know, where else can you get treatment? You know, we'd heard about this amazing clinic in Cleveland, and we decided that maybe you should go over and see what they thought.
Yeah. So I kind of wanted a second opinion on it, even though I kind of knew like it's not going to change anything too much, but I wanted to get a second opinion because there might be a different way of treating it, or I might learn something new over there. So there's a place called the Cleveland Clinic, which is this massive medical campus in Cleveland, like goes on for blocks and blocks and blocks, but it's probably the best MS kind of clinic in the world, and lucky enough that one of our good friends dad is a professor, a cardiologist, and he was able to kind of do a bit of research on it and find that place and also link me in with he reached out to them and got a name of a doctor there, and I got an appointment quite quickly. So I went to went over to Cleveland on, I was just actually looking at photos of this last night. It was the 1st of June. So it was only 3 months later, really.
Mm. And you were in a wheelchair.
And I was in a wheelchair, not because of MS. So the funniest thing is that the biggest fear I had of being in a wheelchair with MS was caused by a sausage on the beach. And the story behind that is the week before I was due to fly to Cleveland, we were down in Wexford, and we decided to be all romantic. It was a gorgeous day and we said, let's have breakfast on the beach. So we got a barbecue, one of those throwaway barbecues, and a load of sausages and all the rest. Yeah, for breakfast. Well, I don't think you actually had them then, even back then.
No, I did used to. I would have had a sausage before the cancer diagnosis.
Okay. I'm glad you did. And then, so we went down to the beach and we were cooking sausages, having a great time. I was looking at photos of it last night going, oh my God, it was really hot. It was a really hot day. It was gorgeous. It was like 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. And we'd had our food and we were, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I moved the barbecue to put it away. And when I moved it, I stood on the sand on the where the barbecue had been. And I don't know if anyone stood on like sand. It's like standing on molten glass. And all I remember feeling was this. It was like I'd stood on a knife and it had gone up through my foot.
Oh my God.
And I knew immediately what I'd done. And I just pegged it into the sea. And I remember you going, what are you doing?
I was like, what happened there? So then I touched the piece of sand over my finger.
You were like, my finger. I was like, my foot. I was like in the sea going, oh my God, the pain. It was just the entire sole of my foot from my heel to my toes was completely burnt.
Mm. So we had to leg it to the VHI, get you all wrapped up, tell the people that you had MS because we were just so freaked out about everything. And yeah, you were going to Cleveland the next week. And I remember you were still undecided as to who was going to Cleveland with you.
Mm.
And then it was like Jason had to go. Your brother Jason had to be the guy because he was going to have to push you everywhere. And your great mates. So Jason had to push you around the airport.
Yeah, he's my big brother. So I was like, okay, well, I need to have my big brother with me on this one because, yeah, you know, you wouldn't be able to push me for one, and two, it was just good to have that sort of male companionship support for that kind of a journey. So yeah, I flew into Chicago, you know, to get a special seat on the plane because of my foot, and it was just a complete disaster. And then when I arrived in Cleveland, everyone started to say, God, you know, they thought I was in a wheelchair because of the MS. I was like, no, I stood on a barbecue. And they're like, oh, how, like in America, they don't have those things. So they're like, how did you stand on a barbecue? So it was, I had to keep, everyone I met, I had to keep explaining it to them. It was so embarrassing. But anyway, they did loads of different kind of tests on me and, you know, mental tests, which was something that was not done here. So like, you know, you answer this questionnaire and it goes through like, do you feel depressed? And on a scale of 1 to 10 and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, within that, then you go and see the doctor and they talk you through all those answers to the questions that you've given them. And, you know, talk to you about, you know, your doctor here and what treatment they're putting you on. And his opinion was, yes, it was MS 100%. You're on the right course. But he also gave me a lot of hope about lots of drugs that they were getting through the FDA in America, like coming down the line. So, and that were, you know, more effective. So my drug was only 30% effective. That's the, basically, it slowed the rate of progression down by 30%, but other drugs slow it down by loads more. So, and they were all coming down the line and showing really good signs. So I definitely left Cleveland boosted by that. And also the fact that there was oral drugs coming, which was, you know, taking a pill every day is an easy thing. And, you know, you don't have to carry ice packs around with you to keep your needles cold and all that stuff. So
that was hugely like educational for you to go there. Yeah. And lovely to spend time with Jason as well.
And the best thing about having Jason there was Chicago airport's a nightmare, and everyone that's been there it's a nightmare. It's huge and you can't get around. So we flew back from Cleveland to Chicago and our flight had gone. Our Dublin flight had gone. So then they rerouted us through London. So we flew Cleveland, Chicago. Instead of going Chicago to Dublin, they routed us to London. And when we got to London, that flight was delayed. And all I remember was Jason, I had my bags on the wheelchair, all stacked up to like my eyeballs. So Jason's bag, my bag, crutches, everything. And Jason just absolutely pissing it through Heathrow Airport, trying to push me up those ramps, up hills, and struggling big time. And I was just going, come on. And actually, to look back, it was actually hilarious. So, you know, everything happens for a reason. And the sausage on the beach happened to give me a laugh in this time.
Dark times.
Darkness, yeah.
So then tell us why you had made the decision then we weren't going to tell many people about it.
Yeah, I didn't feel comfortable. I felt like it was a weakness a little bit in me. You know, I felt like it could show weakness. And at that stage, I was 4 years in as CEO, and I didn't want people knowing. I was kind of a bit embarrassed about it. Mm. And I wasn't sure what my course would be like. So obviously, if I had to keep going in and out of hospital for steroid infusions or the things that come with bad relapse, then I'd have to tell people. But at that point, I just didn't feel like I had to. And I didn't feel like it was anyone's business. And I was I was still so focused on career and achieving goals and getting spin to number one and, you know, being the best and all that sort of stuff. I was like, people can't know I'm weak.
Mm.
Or that there's something wrong with me. I don't want them to know there's something wrong with me. I'm this like young CEO and all this nonsense that doesn't really matter.
So, but you went on to achieve some amazing things in your career after your diagnosis, like winning Media Brand of the Year, which was so huge for you. I remember that being really important and special that you had won that.
So I suppose, okay, I started in Spain with no listeners. I started on the first day. There was nobody listening to the place. And I had handed out flyers and, you know, done all the mad things we did through the years, work-wise and all that sort of stuff. And I got to the CEO position and I just wanted for Spin to be acknowledged. I always felt it wasn't acknowledged enough by the industry for this being as good as it was. So, yeah, I spent the next year. I was like, I need this. I need a win here from a career point of view. And I just spent the next year creating moments, radio moments and all those, and working really hard with Michael and my management team to get Spin to stand out, and then writing the entries and submitting them and and winning Media Brand of the Year against, I think we were against the Irish Times then, and like the Daily Mail, and big, huge, massive media brands that are hugely funded. Spin won it, and I was told on the night, like, you won it by a mile. And that was a big thing for me. And then we went on that year to win every digital award, every social award going. It kind of became a bit of a joke, like, oh, don't enter that because Spin are in it, kind of thing. So that was a very proud moment for me, and kind of validated all the hard work that had gone in, you know, prior to that.
And did the MS make you think differently about how you lived your life? Like, I know you were still hugely ambitious and really hardworking, but what changes did it bring in your life?
Yeah, well, it made me, so starting with diet, like, so I wouldn't have ever, because I was quite active, I wouldn't have ever really cared about what I was eating. I just ate for the function of eating, not actually looking at what I was actually eating. So, you know, people with MS, your myelin, which is that fatty protein that's around the nerves, that repairs much quicker if you have a high omega 3-6-9 diet, so fish oils or, you know, avocados, that kind of stuff. So I just remember one day, a couple of days after the diagnosis, my dad showing up to the house with this giant salmon, like a massive thing. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is my diet for the next forever. Yeah, and just eating lots of healthy food and avoiding foods that can cause inflammation, because it's an inflammatory disease. So being very fussy about what I ate, and sleep, rest, because fatigue is a huge thing with MS. So people with MS feel a lot of fatigue, and that's muscle fatigue, but it's also just, you just are very tired all the time. So yeah, just getting good sleep, but that was something that's evaded me, because at night is when your mind goes into a dark place, and that's what happened for me. And I had and still to this day have some sleep problems, not as bad as I did before. But
what was like running through your mind at night time?
Oh, like, what's gonna happen to me? It was just like, it was almost like mentally rocking back and forth, like, you know, I don't want to be in a wheelchair, and, you know, I don't want to have the pain that can come with MS and all this kind of stuff. And
the fear of the unknown.
The fear of, yeah, because it's such a, your course is just so unknown. So just very, very scared about what lay ahead for me and when that might come. And, oh God, is it going to be in the morning? Will I wake up tomorrow and my other hand be numb? And, you know, that kind of thing.
So what was it like suffering through the night and suffering internally, but putting on this brave face and most people in your life not knowing what's going on?
So I, like, the it's a kind of an oxymoron, because I was lying there going, I can't sleep, I can't sleep, I can't sleep. I really need to sleep, but I can't sleep. So, like, I was making myself not sleep because my brain was being, like, really active. And then I'd wake up in the morning and, yeah, get ready for work and go in and just try and forget about it. But you never forgot about it. I never forgot about it. It would enter my head every minute. And, like, you know, I'd be worried about slurring my speech in front of people and all that kind of stuff, because that can happen with MS. So it was tough, but it's that I put on a brave face and got on with it and tried to hide it. But it's exhausting doing that, because that's not, like, really what's happening behind the eyes.
We told friends of ours last weekend, and I remember saying that, you know, you seemed like in good spirits after we told them, and you said, yeah, because I have been burdened with this secret for 8 years, and now I can finally be free.
Mm.
What does it feel like when you tell people?
Yeah, it's definitely like, it's a relief. It's a relief feeling. And that's, you know, another reason why I wanted to talk about this now and use this platform to talk about it, because I've been carrying this for 8 years. And, you know, I just think opening up and talking about these things will relieve that. Like, you know, I'm hiding something. I have been hiding it for 8 years, and that's exhausting. I'm just kind of sick of hiding it. And this is me. This is who I am. I have this. I've accepted it. Probably only recently accepted it when I think about it. That's why I want to talk about it. But it's exhausting carrying something like this around with you and, like, actively doing it. Because, like, I will get tired. I will switch off. I'll zone out of conversations and things like when, you know, we're happy, we're out for dinner or whatever. That's cause, and I don't want them to think I'm rude or whatever, but that's just because I'm tired because I have MS, but I can't tell anyone so they don't understand. Jesus, she's lovely, but her husband's a dick.
Oh my God. But I think we really have learned so much, and I suppose maybe we've gained time in the last couple of years. So we've gotten off this roller coaster of, you know, working all week and being exhausted at the weekends. We've spent more time together recently than we ever have in our lives. Mm. We are permanently outside connecting with nature. You know, we are educating ourselves in life. And I always think the quote that always stands out to me is that choice is one of the most powerful things we have. And you have made the choice now to be your true self. So how do you think you're going to feel on Sunday when this podcast is released?
I think it'll just be a real weight off my shoulders. Mm. And that's my true self. This is my truth. And I think more people, particularly men, should probably just speak their truth. You know, you did a really good podcast with Keith Walsh, you know, where he was speaking his truth. He talked about depression and how he was feeling. I think that's inspiring. And I think the more men that do that, then the less mental health problems we'll have. Like, I've never, thank God, really been touched with depression. I think I probably was depressed a little bit after this diagnosis, as anyone is with some sort of a chronic illness diagnosis. But I'm not depressed now. I'd certainly think that relieving this will relieve me of any kind of feelings like that ever, really, because I'm not carrying a secret, and that's mm-hmm. me.
You also gave yourself the gift of time. So it's taken you 8 years to get to this point, but you're here and you're better than ever and you're in a really good place. What do you think has contributed to you getting to this point?
So, well, I think you have contributed to it, and watching how you have, you know, bravely spoken about your illness and what's, you know, what that's done for you is a big thing, one of the reasons. But yeah, it's Pia, it's everything. It's just being a lot more comfortable, spending time outside in nature. And that's the one thing I'd say to anyone, as anyone's going through anything at all. Like, nature is the greatest healer. So the more you spend time, you spend, like, we're all made of the same stuff. We're all carbon and water and all that sort of stuff. The same, I'm made up of what a tree is made up of. So you have to spend time with that stuff to feel connected. And definitely being outdoors and, you know, getting fresh air and all that kind of stuff. Like, everyone goes, I'm going for a walk to get some fresh air. That's because they feel better after, because they're spending time in nature. So immersed, you know, in nature over the last little while, certainly within the lockdown, we've spent so much time outside, that's made me feel so much better and more comfortable with this whole thing.
Another thing that I just wanted to mention really quickly, and I won't get bogged down in this, but I think it's just so important to mention, is the significance of the numbers 15 and 17 in our lives.
Yeah, it's weird. They seem to crop up. So at all the big times.
So I wrote this down. So you were diagnosed on the 15th. Of March. Mm-hmm. We got engaged on the 15th of July. Mm-hmm. We got married on the 17th in 2015. Mm-hmm. And Pia was born on the 15th in 2017. And I found a lump in my breast on the 5th of the 10th, 2017. So this number 15 kept creeping up for us. Yeah. And I remember being freaked out about it at the very start, before the breast cancer, before Pia was born, before our wedding day. So I contacted my friend Sinead Dehore this morning and just asked her about the numbers 15 and 17. She said she had goosebumps all over her body when I told her. She said the number 15 represents a change in direction. and also teaching, whether that's a lesson to yourself or a lesson to others. So I think so much stuff has happened to us on the 15th, like you being diagnosed the 5th of the 10th, which adds up to 15, the day I found my lump and the day Pia was born, was all just so many huge lessons in our lives. And then she said the number 17 is a really lucky number and it means you're on the right track. So I just thought it was really important just to mention that, you know, that just is just so weird, isn't it? And that's when I look into things like that and I write down all the dates that both bad and good things happen to us, I really like trust in the universe that this was meant to be our path.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to do all this together. I was supposed to be by your side when you were diagnosed with MS. You were unbelievable when I got sick, because you knew what it was like. Yeah. And you could guide me and tell me,
yeah,
this won't hurt as much in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Yeah. And I'm so glad that we have been able to tell people now, you know, so people can understand us a little bit better, and understand that, yes, we've gone through some really tough times in the last decade, but I wouldn't change any of it because it's put us on the path that we're on today of a huge appreciation for life, understanding, you know, our feelings, and, you know, it's given us the power to be our true selves and to turn to people like Jerry Hussey and listen and take in all these lessons. And yet we're still so young. Mm. Like, you're 40 next week. I really feel like this is a new beginning for us. Especially 2020 has been a real transition period, I think.
Yeah, it's like I'm here now talking about this. A year ago, I would have never wanted to have been here talking about this. So it is a transition. It's a new decade in my life, certainly coming up in the next thing as I head towards my 50s from my 40s, you know.
Oh my God.
Look, you just mentioned something there about it, you know, teaching. Like, the greatest thing that MS taught me was resilience. And that for me, you know, I'm quite a resilient person anyway, but it gave me an extra layer of resilience. And I'm a practical person as well. So, like, I look at problems and I say, okay, well, how can I solve this? I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything like this, but I've always been, I can fix this kind of person. So I've always had some level of resilience there, because that's kind of connected, you know. So problem solving for me comes naturally. So I, you know, this is a problem, and when I got MS, I was like, right, how do I navigate this? And it's diet and exercise and all that kind of stuff, but it's mental resilience as well. And the best thing that MS did for me was give me the ability to help you through your diagnosis, because I knew the path, I knew what the tests meant, I knew what it was like to go for all that stuff, I knew what it was like to have a very serious illness. And, you know, we spent those nights on the couches, and I don't know if I hadn't got MS that I could have kept it together myself, let alone helped you keep it together. So that's the best thing that MS gave me, but it gave me a lot of other things. It's made me grow as a person. It's given me a really kind of good appreciation for the now, like living in the present, and definitely just like I appreciate stuff. Like, I go walk out of our house and we go into the field at the back and I'm like, this is gorgeous here, I love the grass, you know, like the basic things in life, the important things, time with Pia, time with you, you know, swimming in the sea, going for runs, you know, like I did a 26k mountain run the other day, and as I was running through this, I was like running through this meadow and I got this massive surge of like happiness and stuff. It was like this, but just as I was looking around going, Jesus, Ireland is stunning, we live in the most beautiful place in the world. So it's given me that appreciation for just my surroundings and just being present. Like, I did, years ago, I just kept running and being like, not even noticed anything. But now I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. So yeah, like a kind of a hyper awareness. That's what I think. A hyper awareness of my own health, but also hyper awareness of other stuff around me, which is nice to be able to tune into that. And it's also given me kind of the ability to focus on things I can actually impact, make an impact with or change. You know, I don't sweat the stuff that I can't change anymore. So I used to, but I don't do that anymore. And I kind of ask myself, everything that I do is like, will this be good for me or will this not be good for me? And that's how I make a decision now. And that's what it's taught me, that kind of thing. Okay, well, if I do this, is this actually going to help me or not? Or is this mm-hmm. going to make me stressed? Okay, I'm not doing it because stress impacts MS. So it's given me that. I would have never had that, those filters before, or that ability to process that information to make a right decision, you know. Mm-hmm.
So how does the MS affect you now, or does it at all?
Yeah, I'm really lucky that I'm kind of symptom free. I'm really well. It doesn't really affect me at all. In the first couple of years, I had those first few relapses where I had numbness or balance issues and a bit of fatigue. But apart from that, everything is fine at the moment. I'm really fit. I'm healthier than I've ever been. I haven't had any relapses or any physical symptoms in a very long time. So that's where I'm at.
I heard a quote a couple of months ago. What have you carried for long enough that it's time to let go of? And I think that is so relevant to what you're doing right now. I think speaking your truth is going to help so many people and give hope to so many people that you're well today and you're able to exercise and live a normal life. And I just wanted to say, I'm so proud of you. Like, my heart is full of love for you, and it always has been. And I think as well, what MS gave you was precious moments with your mum and dad. Your dad isn't with us anymore, but those moments will be with you for the rest of your life, and that closeness to our families.
Yeah, like on those real tough times, definitely remember those things with my dad, particularly, you know, who passed away a couple of years ago. And I'll hold them forever, like so.
Well, I'm just so excited to find out what's next for us, and to, I suppose, this feels like a new beginning. So again, I'm so proud of you and I love you so much.
Yeah, and thank you for helping me throughout the whole process of the last 8 years, and to get to this place to be able to comfortably talk about it and not feel embarrassed or ashamed or whatever weird feelings I have. And I definitely right now feel like a weight is kind of off my shoulders. So onwards and upwards, and let's see what else we can do together.
Amazing. Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, with thanks to Sally Hansen. As we all find ourselves washing our hands so much more these days, why not take better care of our nails with Sally Hansen's Cuticle Oil or Complete Care 7-in-1. You can shop the products at grocery stores and pharmacies nationwide, such as Dunn Stores and Macaulay's Health and Beauty, and online too. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. And for more on my story, follow me on Instagram, Georgie.Bufford.